All right, it's time for another episode of Shooting the Shit with Miles. Now, this episode is probably releasing at the same time as episode 16, if everything goes as planned. And today's episode is going to be a little different. I know normally I take this time to talk about specific issues or things that I think are funny or need to be talked about. But instead today, we've got a guest on with us. You know, a little interview. Here I've got Mikey Moratini, and he's a director, songwriter, artist, all-around creative, and I'm bringing him on today to talk about a new film that's coming out on May 25th called Evil Everywhere. Everybody say hi to Mikey. How's it going, Mikey?
Hey, it's going all right. I'm prepping a new film, and I'm actually really excited about the release of this film because honestly, I filmed Evil Everywhere between 2017 and 2019, and it's only now just getting released, so
okay.
It's been a long journey.
I bet, yeah, that's a while, damn. Okay, yeah. Right on, that's at least, what, like 4 years? Man.
Yeah, from start to actual release, yeah.
Jeez. All right, well, tell me a little bit about yourself first and kind of your journey to directing this movie, but I know you do other stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other stuff on the table for you.
Right. I've been like making videos since I was 8 years old, so this is not like a new thing for me. It's the first time I've ever had like a feature film released. It's the first time I've ever made a feature film. Mm-hmm. But I've been doing a lot of short films. I joined YouTube when YouTube was created. I was 13 years old. So I was looking for a place to share my little movies that I was making with my friends. And I joined in 2005 when YouTube started up, or whenever it was, like 2004 or 5.
Yeah,
well,
I remember too. Yeah,
yeah.
That's a while ago.
And I do music. I have a project I call Moonbear Star Tiger, and it's so far it's been like a solo thing. It's really lo-fi, and I kind of just like I make this weird industrial goth music on my computer, and I play bass and synth, and it's really strange. And ideally, I want to form a band and do that like a full band thing at some point. But right now, I've kind of been having to work with the COVID situation, and you know, it seemed like movies were kind of the thing that had the more momentum. So I've been doing short films, and I started a web series called Captain Fantasy that I star in. And now I'm casting and prepping for another short horror film. So I like to teeter between comedy and horror, and if I feel like I'm getting too far in the direction of goofy, silly stuff, I like to break it up and do something serious and scary.
Right, I get you.
Yeah.
Come on. That's cool. So it's interesting you kind of bring up the COVID things. This is something I've been wondering a little bit. You know how they're starting to shift away from, like, the traditional movie release, right? Like, you'd always have to go down to the local IMAX or your local, movie theater, but now it's like all the big movies are starting to come out on streaming platforms.
Yeah.
So it's almost like we're moving away from the traditional movie releases, and now everybody's really like, I'd rather stay home and watch it on the Netflix or whoever.
I'm looking for any reason to leave my house these days. I am very well, yeah. Dude, like, I'm here in the three-dimensional world. I want to partake in physical, tangible experiences where I'm going out and I'm with other people and doing things. I had kind of a sheltered upbringing, so, like, I kind of, like, grew up sitting around on my computer, and I wanted to be part of the world, and I wanted to be socializing and out having fun. And I think, like, after years and years and years of, like, various dealings with mental illness and whatever. I'm kind of like at a point now where I'm like, dude, like I'm reborn. I feel this zest for life, and I want to get out there and play shows, and I want to do all this stuff. And it just so happens that the moment I started to get out in the world, I moved to Chicago last year, right when COVID dropped.
Oh,
so
man.
I was like, all right. So now everybody else is like, no, I want to just stay inside and watch TV. I'm like, dude, I want to get my films in theaters. I want to go play shows. I want to go and mingle and go to music festivals. Like, I have a zest for life, and I love what I do, and I make no bones about it. I dig watching stuff on Netflix, but nothing beats that experience of going to like a huge theater and sitting in the audience and being so immersed in that whole experience.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's definitely there's a quality difference there.
Yeah.
So what I think is interesting is I'm wondering if this will make it easier for like prospective filmmakers to like get their shit in front of more people, because if it goes to a streaming platform, it's more accessible. Whereas, like, getting to a movie theater, there's a lot of barriers there, mostly financial, you know?
And that's, you know, that's to be determined. Like, I'm really psyched that this is getting out, like, professionally. Because I'm only ever used to, like, releasing stuff on YouTube, so it's always been my dream to do stuff that gets on Netflix, Prime, whatever it may be, like, video. At the end of the day, I just want people to see what I'm doing. I want to make sure that the things that I'm creating are falling into the right eyes and ears for people that enjoy this type of material. And I think that sometimes on YouTube, the platform sort of drifted into this direction of like people making vlogs and informational videos and talking about their daily lives. And I'm not really interested in doing that. Like, I love to talk about myself, but that's not where my first priority is. My first priority is as a creator. So definitely I put myself into what I do, but it's more of a nuanced and kind of conceptual way. Like, I make these films and they say something about me as an artist, and I make this physical art, I paint and all that stuff, and I make my music, of course. But I just think that the platform of YouTube has become kind of this like popularity contest where everybody's just sort of like promoting one thing or another. And it's all about, hey, what's up, guys? I've got this new thing for you today. And I'm just not that type of person. I can't pretend to be that kind of person. So I'm definitely more like old school, like artist, filmmaker, person. I want to have things in theaters. I like going to events and all that stuff.
Right. Right. One more thing before we kind of move on to talking about the movie. You said you were there kind of when YouTube started up, and I assume you've kind of been watching it as it's aged and everything.
Yeah.
And I've never really got involved in YouTube because it just, by the time I started up this podcast and stuff, and then I started doing Twitch streams and everything, man, I feel like the YouTube community has gotten like real toxic. Like, it's...
Yeah, it has.
It's every time I put something out there about, like, I did a video recently making fun of Ben Shapiro because he thinks the Derek Chauvin conviction went the wrong way. And it was like, only Chuds posted comments on that video. It's the running trend.
I do my best to stay out of the community aspect of YouTube. It is really just like, it's the only means I really feel like I have at the moment for sharing my kind of short film content. And again, like, I make short films. Like, I am a filmmaker. I'm not a YouTuber.
Right.
And definitely, I think that's a platform made of people that want to mouth opinions on certain topics. I'm not interested in that. I try to stay out of the worldly issues. I don't like inciting flame wars. I'm all about the art and the creativity. So yeah, I mean, like, back in the day, it was favored more that, like, no matter who you are, you would get, like, lots and lots of views. And then they started tailoring it towards, like, if you're making like content every week and you're bringing in X amount of views, then we're going to help you promote. And otherwise, we're going to bury your content with the algorithm so that barely any people see it. And that's kind of, that felt disheartening to me at times. And that's kind of why I figured with Evil Everywhere, I was like, let me just forego the YouTube process. I'm not going to do that. Let me just submit it to some production companies, distribution companies, and see if anybody wants to distribute this on video and streaming, like, professionally. And it just so happens that Wild Eye accepted it, and I was just thrilled. And it's a really big milestone for me as a creative individual to have a feature film that's being professionally put out there.
No, that's great. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about it. Tell me a little bit about Evil Everywhere, like kind of what it's about, and what was your vision for this movie, and how close do you think you came to nailing it?
Sure. In 2014, I made this short film that was a Grindhouse parody trailer. I love the films of Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, Mario Bava, Lamberto Bava, like all that crazy balls to the wall Italian horror. So I made this trailer called Paura Tutto, which means roughly fear all in Italian. And it was the story of Zeke Zanderfelt, the last kid in the yearbook, and how he's trying to band together with this mysterious girl with no name to stop this mystical evil force from picking off the senior class. Mm-hmm. And I did that in 2014, and it was a cool short fake trailer that lasted about 11 minutes long, so quite a long trailer. And I did a lot of like funny gag kill scenes and bad dubbing and all this stuff. Flash forward a couple years later, I've made a couple of short films, and then I get this inspiration around early 2017. I'm like, I want to make another 80s horror film, and it just kind of made sense. Let me do a follow-up to Paura Tutto. And so I started Evil Everywhere, and at first it was going to be another fake trailer, and it was going to be 2 years later after all that stuff went down in the other film. We pick up and here's Zeke Zanderfelt again. He's got to face the evil again. But then I was like, during production, I was like, let me add some scenes onto this. I'm going to flesh this out. This is going to be a full movie. And so I just kept adding and like going back and rewriting stuff and adding more characters in and more bits and more gags and stuff like that. And I was having a blast, and it took me a long time because I had to keep coordinating with different people and saying, okay, well, this person's only free next month, so I have to wait another month to film with this person. And I was literally, aside from four of the principal cast, most everybody that appears in Evil Everywhere was either a friend of mine or they were a relative of mine, just somebody I kind of shoulder tapped and said, like, hey, would you mind doing this scene? Here's your character. This is what goes down. So there's a lot of like amateurs in there that never really acted before. And then mixed in there is some of the principal cast that they are actors that I, you know, put a casting call on backstage.com and got them specifically for those roles. But yeah, it was a lot of fun because I kept adding to it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is becoming its own new thing. And I was thinking midway through production, like, do I need to like tack the original film at the beginning and make that part of this new film? And then I thought the best way to do that was just to do like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre opening title crawl where it kind of you know, detailed the events of the original short, and then we're like 2 years later, here we are now, and there's the movie. So yeah, it might be confusing for some people, but I think it can work without you having to see the other one, because I did kind of sum it up in the opening titles there. Yeah, kind of a weird idea. It's a sequel, but it plays kind of like it's the first.
Right. I getcha. Yeah. It's interesting you bring up like the production and stuff. I remember I was recently on another podcast, Your New Favorite Movie, and we were talking about a movie that I particularly enjoyed was Rob Zombie's remake of Halloween.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And dropped into a conversation about an interview I read when I was doing like some research about it, about how Rob Zombie was talking about the reason he didn't want to do a Halloween 3, like the follow-up to the sequel, because he was too rushed through the second project. Even the first project, he didn't feel like he had enough time. And the interview asked him, like, well, what about Houses of a Thousand Corpses? And Rob Zombie was like, that was like the perfect film where I had all the time I needed.
Yeah.
You know, I had the budget. I could go back and I could add or take out. And by the end of it, he was like, this is exactly what I want. It's not missing anything. Doesn't need anything. Produce it. Is that how you feel like this project, because you had so much time, is that kind of where you feel like it ended up, or is there still something you would want to see put in?
Definitely.
Feel like it's missing?
Yeah. This had no budget. So when I list the budget on IMDb, I literally funded this out of pocket. So I'm talking like, I would go to the thrift store and I would buy the wardrobe for everybody in the movie. And people are like, why are you doing this? And I'm like, because this is my passion. They're like, what are you going to, like, what's the end goal? I'm like, to have a finished film. Like, I'm one of those nutty artist guys who, like, I care so much about what I do, I'm like going bankrupt because I'm doing it. And other people, I think that speaks a lot of to integrity. And I think I like Rob Zombie because he sticks to his vision, like whether or not people like it. And a lot of people give him flack for the kind of movies he makes. But, you know, whether I like him or not, I like the fact that he just knows what he wants and he goes for it and he does really kind of brutal things. And he makes unfavorable decisions. And I tend to really gravitate towards filmmakers and artists that have this strong sense of conviction about what they want. I had to make it work the best that I could, given the fact that I was just one guy holding together this entire movie made up of casual friends and acquaintances. So I didn't have any studio backing. I didn't have a crew. I didn't have people funding this or promoting it as I made it. I was just one guy living in this middle of nowhere suburb, just wrangling whoever, whenever I could, and doing what I could when I could. So yeah, I had to sacrifice my vision in some ways, but I think I made it ambitious enough that like some of those effects shots were like a fun challenge. There's a lot of shots in the movie where I had to figure out how to pull off these makeup effects and these, like, you know, these gore effects from scratch. And I just figured it out in the most DIY indie way I could. We built a set in my mom's garage for this bloody massacre scene, because I knew that nobody would let me spray blood all over the walls in any real bedroom. So I had to build the set just for that scene. And I was like, oh my God, we went through all that trouble. We're going to get the most out of this that we can. So it was like, it was like a hodgepodge of like, I knew this guy and he could get us into his college and we could film in the hallways of the college and use that as the mental hospital. And I knew this guy who had a 1980s car. So I did one day where I just filmed him driving around in a 1980s car. So I think that's kind of like, that'll make the movie more interesting to watch, is just knowing that, like, I had no money to put towards this. It was just my own money from, like, disability, basically. And I was just, like, putting it to this film. And people are like, that's crazy, man. And I'm like, I love what I do, man. And it'll pay off down the line. You just got to stick with it, you know?
Right. I mean, so, Bill Gates started out of his garage, and now he's got Apple.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And like Kevin Smith maxed out a bunch of credit cards to make Clerks. You know, he like sold all his comics and maxed out credit cards to make Clerks. And people are like, "You're crazy. You got to stick with these things." And I love when people have the faith to invest time in my films, because I think we always end up getting a good film out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's all it really takes, is that persistence and that trust that, like, we're gonna do this. We're gonna make the best of what we have here.
Very nice. So, tell me about a little bit more about the movie or the project you're working on now. Are you facing similar hurdles as you did with Evil Everywhere, from like the budgeting standpoint and getting everybody coordinated, or how's that going?
Yeah, because I'm feeling like I have to start from scratch here. I've moved to a new town. I live in Antioch, Illinois right now. I've got my own place. Some of the things are kind of falling into place really nicely, but I've started to have to put out casting calls and just start connecting with people from scratch, because I don't have that backlog of actors where I'm like, oh, I know this person, person's good for that. That's the goal, is to get a good community of people I know that are available, they're reliable, so I can kind of, move beyond the mistakes that I made on Evil Everywhere and make sure that I'm not casting people and having them bail on production the day of. Which was a real thing that happened during Evil Everywhere. And they try to spin it like it's my fault, and they're like, I wasn't prepared. And I was like, you said you would be ready by this day. We all agreed on it. I followed through. I did all of the things that I could possibly do on my end, and you failed to show. That's not my fault. So I'm being really transparent up front. I'm saying I'm making this movie. I don't have a budget. I really want to pay you guys. I really do. I wish I was being paid for this stuff soon, but at the moment, like, just make it work with no money. And it kind of weeds out the people that are, they're only in it for the money. If they'll come out and they'll dedicate time to something because of the quality of the project, that's literally the kind of person that I'm looking for. I don't want to have to convince anybody. I'm not like a chaser. I don't want to have to chase you down and, oh, please be in my movie, because this is not fun anymore. Right. I'm pulling from people that are close by. So I'm being like extra cautious this time. I'm like, all right, are you close by? Do you have what's your availability like? Do you have enough time to do this?
Right.
And it's called, I should mention what it's about. It's called The Bride. It's another kind of horror, but it's not an 80s spoof or anything. And I'm not really going for the comedy for this one. Mm-hmm. I won't give away too much, but it sort of plays like a kind of Midwestern Gothic folktale. That's the best way I can come up with summing it up.
Interesting.
Black and white, gritty noir. Yeah.
Right. Interesting. So I've always been a horror movie fan. Like, most of my high school years was just becoming an aficionado of quality horror films from like the 80s, early 90s. Love that shit.
Yeah, that was my teenage years.
There you go. So do you feel like any of those films, or which of those films, do you feel like had the most influence when you were conceptualizing and writing out Evil Everywhere?
Most of them. Like, everything. I'm sort of like an autistic savant in that, like, I take in a lot of stuff and I'm sort of obsessed with certain things. But instead of like fanboying and like collecting things, I just like absorb the qualities I like about them and I channel that through the things that I make. Right. So in Evil Everywhere, I mean, there's like homages to John Carpenter. There's homages to Hellraiser, Nightmare on Elm Street, B-movies like that Frank Henenlotter would make, or Troma, of course. That's why I got Dylan Mars Greenberg to be in the film, because I'm a big fan of Troma and I was seeing her involvement in Troma films, and we were friends on Facebook, and I said, hey, Dylan, would you be a cameo in this film? I always wanted to work at Troma and just make like these crazy ass films. I love The Toxic Avenger, Basket Case. They acquired Frank Henenlotter's films lately, I saw, which is really cool. So Basket Case and Frankenhooker and that kind of stuff. I love that stuff. Terror Vision is one of my favorites. Killer Clowns from Outer Space. I love the goofier, lighter ones are a little more fun to watch. So I did my best to kind of like work that sense of humor into the film. And of course, I have to make mention of J.R. Bookwalter's The Dead Next Door, because I feel like I was kind of inspired by what he was doing, where he was like one guy in Akron, Ohio, making his big zombie film. And it took him 4 years from start to finish to do. And he also scored the film, and I think there's a lot of similarities. So I kind of pay homage to The Dead Next Door. In my film, I have a bit where a guy's being stabbed to death and she removes his hat and he goes, "No, not my hat." And that's a little bit out of that movie.
Right. Very cool, very cool. Okay, so it's rare I get to talk to somebody who likes horror movies as much as I do. You probably like them more. I don't even know who directed most of them, besides like the big directors like John Carpenter and stuff. But within the past probably 2 decades or so, we've seen a lot of movies where it's like, you know, Freddy versus Jason.
Ugh.
And there was like a Sadako versus Kayako sort of face-off sort of thing. What would you want, like, assuming that the movie quality was good this time, which two, like, famous 80s era horror characters would you want to see face off in a movie?
I want to see Marty from Slaughter High come back and face off against someone. I want to see them make a really good Slaughter High sequel. And that's a really rare but interesting 1986 slasher that I think more people should know about that film, because it's funny, but like in a so bad it's good way.
Right.
Good gore. And I think the killer is cool. He wears a jester mask and he carries a mallet, I think.
Interesting. I haven't actually heard of this one. Go ahead and tell me a little bit about that movie.
I don't know if it involved some of the people from Friday the 13th or it was just scored by Harry Manfredini, who scored the Friday the 13th series. Right. But it stars Carolyn Monroe, and she's a B-movie horror staple. And the guy who plays Marty, the lead killer, Simon Scudamore, he committed suicide shortly after the film's production. So there's that like omen around the production, and I think that kind of... that's what people remember about it. But it's a good one. I think... it was recently released on Blu-ray, I believe. But other than that, I used to have to get bootleg copies on video. It's very interesting. I forgot why I brought that up, but I think I would like to see something done with that character. Or maybe the Killer Clowns versus something. But I tend to think that versus movies are gimmicky. And
sure,
I don't... Yeah. It's hard for me to suspend my disbelief to believe that these two killers exist in the same universe. Because I think that to make horror films work, you have to kind of ground it in its own sort of logical reality. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of like... the Friday the 13th films fell off the track and the Nightmare on Elm Street films fell off the track because they started to get far-fetched. And I stopped believing in the reality that the films were presenting.
Right.
So yeah, and I back on your topic about 10 to 20 years ago, horror as far as horror goes, I think that it doesn't interest me anymore, and I think that it's gotten too far into the high budget. You know, how can we shock people? Saw was a good movie and there was this level of suspense, and I think that most people agree that it was, you know, a good film. And then I think the sequels were just constantly trying to one up the last one. How can we make this more brutal and gory? And that might sound hypocritical because my film Evil Everywhere is very gory, but I think that if that becomes the horror mainstay, is just how gross can we make this, it sort of takes away from the impact of what you're showing the audience. Because back in the day, there used to be that element of suspense and character development and production value. And now I think it's just like a gore show. You know, I'm not, offense to anyone, but I'm not a fan of the Hatchet series. I think it's just purely gratuitous.
I feel like I've heard of that. I haven't seen it though. Isn't that like a late 2000s or like 2000 aunts sort of thing?
Yeah, it's 2006 onward or something. Because I remember when I was starting to get hardcore into the horror scene as a teenager in the mid 2000s, I started hearing all about that. And I went to a horror convention and they were talking about it. I think like when it's done right, it could be funny and interesting, but I think if it's overdone, and I think a lot of films are very jump scare oriented and gimmicky. Yeah. And I mean, I can't talk too much because that's what Evil Everywhere is. it's an over the top gore in your face, no subtlety, but I intended it that way for comedic value.
Sure.
I kind of miss the days of like John Carpenter and some of those more suspenseful films, even like Dawn of the Dead. There's a lot of, you know, groundedness that I think is missing from the later horror films, where it's all very in your face and here's another thing flying at you. And Here's a guy getting bisected and, you know, aha, LOL, look at all this gore.
Right.
I don't know. I like a little bit of a balance sometimes. And I think that I tend to stay away from that type of stuff nowadays because it's just a little too bleak.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it sounds like a lot of your assessments of these kind of more recent movies have come from more of like a professional background. So, you know, you have the skills for making movies and like kind of what to look for and like thematic stuff, things that are definitely beyond me. But let me ask, is there like an example of a more recent movie within like the last 20 years that you think did do a good job and like kind of did meet some of those standards that you're looking for that just some of these other films didn't?
Absolutely. It Follows. I think that
film is fantastic. I do remember that film. Yeah,
I think that film was fantastic. And if I might say so, it was because I was such a fan of It Follows that reinvigorated my passion to do Evil Everywhere. And it all started because I loved the soundtrack. And I started to look up Disaster Piece because I'm psyched anytime somebody does something that pays homage to 80s horror films nowadays. So when I see a movie like that feels very much like a John Carpenter type film, and it's a little more subtle and it's like well paced and the soundtrack is very synthy, I'm going to look into it a little bit more. And so I was like, I love this film. I have this passion reignited inside of me to make another 80s style horror film. And it just so happened that the first idea I came up with was Evil Everywhere. And I kind of based the music that I did a little bit around the It Follows soundtrack because it was just so fantastic. And I think they just did it right. And there was just certain nuances down to the way it was shot that just were just brilliant. I like that artistry in a horror film. I think some casual viewers don't really pay attention to that sort of stuff. But as a cinematographer, I do. I love films that have a cool look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. It's like... most of my experience when it comes to like gauging if a movie is good or not has a lot to do with like the plot. Like if I am like intrigued by the story, I'll tend to follow it, you know, but if it's like gets too out there, or there's like too many, like, what is that? You know, how did we get here sort of thing? I lose interest. But what do you think would be some things that for the like casual viewer that you think they should start paying attention to when they watch movies like this and kind of get a new appreciation for it? Like, where would you start to get people more kind of in tune with what they're watching?
I don't know that I'd use Evil Everywhere as an example for that, because I think that I very well knew I wanted this to be a janky, disjointed kind of like a film that you'd imagine had like three or four different directors. Right. And it was like, I wanted it to give it the impression that maybe there was like a weird production behind it. Because I try to be really meta with this stuff. So like even the way I cut it, sometimes there's weird jump cuts where it looks like the film kind of skipped. Right. So I'm trying to like affect that. The idea that like this is like a European American joint production, and the directors couldn't communicate with each other, so we have these scenes that kind of like stand out and they seem like they're out of context, and some of the dubbing is a little bit off. So I think if you're watching this, look for stuff like that and understand kind of the intention maybe behind it. Like, because I think I heard somebody comment who's seen the film, they said it was a good film to like watch and laugh at while you're drinking, and I was like, exactly. Like, I love I love Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, and that's a British series that was on a couple years ago, 2004. Classic. It ran on Adult Swim back in the late 2000s, like 2010 or 11, I think. And I caught it on Adult Swim, and I became obsessed. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. It's made to appear as if it's a lost 1980s horror series, complete with bad production value and everything. So that very much influenced what I'm doing with Evil Everywhere, where like you're intentionally trying to make it look like it's just a bad 80s film, but the joke isn't like, ha ha ha, it's the 80s. The joke is like, it's playing it straight. Like, this is just like a silly, weird 1980s artifact, and you're watching it.
Okay.
So I think, I don't know, look for stuff like that, I guess. But I'd say, in terms of like films overall, I tend to be way more focused on the characters and the feel of the film. I'm very much of a sensory type of artist and filmmaker. It's about the emotion and sort of the energy and the flow of the thing. And so that's what I try to cultivate to the best of my ability when I create things, is just sort of a sense, you know, like a vibe, which you either like or you don't. And
That's interesting that you bring that up. Recently, I'm the kind of guy who likes to watch all kinds of stuff in all kinds of different forms in terms of like my visual media. I like live action stuff. I like animated stuff. I like anime. Mm-hmm. And I remember I recently got my mom to start watching an anime series called The Promised Neverland. And okay. She actually got really invested in it. She's actually like, she really wants to see how that ends, but which is so funny because she normally doesn't go for anything animated. But it was very interesting to me, this sort of conversation we had while we were watching that film. And it kind of touches on what you were talking about, where whenever you're trying to convey like emotion through a visual medium, it's always very difficult because you're not standing there in front of the person. And typically, like in our everyday lives, when you talk to someone, it's not a super like emotive experience usually. Yeah. And what I find was interesting is that the way, because like whenever you do anything related to like a visual, like a TV show or a movie or something, you need to have kind of this over emotive state so that your audience will understand like right. what the character is feeling without them saying, right. I'm sad, you know?
Yeah, but definitely.
It looks different in different cultures, though. And the conversation I had with my mom while we were watching this anime, she's like, why are they doing that? Why are those characters like have these facial expressions or whatever?
Yeah.
And it occurred to me, I was like, oh, I guess that's like the cultural norm for them. Like in their culture, they understand those, you know, facial yeah. expressions, those the funny little mannerisms as like emotional content. So what kind of things did you try to incorporate to kind of have your characters emote the way you wanted to them emote? And kind of create an atmosphere or like that emotional content that you were looking for? Like, what are some of the things you employed?
Well, I let everybody know from the get-go, like, I'm looking... this isn't a good example of how I would usually direct a film that was meant to be authentic and genuine. Sure. Because Evil Everywhere from the get-go was, you know, I was like, hey guys, you know how to do like wooden B-movie acting. And I think they did a really good job of wooden B-movie acting, and that was the goal, so they succeeded. Nice. But usually, as a filmmaker, I'm a very emotional guy. I'm very sensitive, I'm empathic. I feel emotions deeply, and I've been through a lot of things in my life that shook me to the core. So mm-hmm. I know how to go to those places and what they feel like. And I'm the kind of person that'll walk into a room and get a sense of the energy in the room. And I think that that translates to me being able to articulate that on screen with at least some of the things that I've been doing with film and hope to do in the future as I delve more into dramatic territory. It's just knowing those feelings, even if you're not looking at the feeling, it's just knowing how to bring that out of the actors and how to shoot that and how to articulate that through the editing and the pacing of the film, I think is important. Because yeah, you're not always going to have people on camera that are like, you know, frowning and going, oh, I'm sad. So there's other ways to communicate it that are more nuanced that I think it takes all of the elements in filmmaking to truly capture.
Interesting.
And not just the acting.
Right, I was going to say, it's not just like one thing then. It's not just on the actor, it's also on like the sound guy and the camera guy and the lighting guy.
The music and everything. Because I know I've seen movies where the performances were good, but the dialogue was bad and the way it was shot was bad. So as a filmmaker myself, I tend to watch movies and see the creative process. Mm-hmm. And that that's something that I think a lot of casual viewers who aren't filmmakers, they'll watch the movie and they'll be a little more prone to be immersed in the experience, then they won't notice the shots and the angles and that kind of thing, and that's very subconscious. I notice those things. I notice the shots, I notice the angles and the cuts and the music. So sometimes if one of those elements is out of place or it's standing out too much, it can really take you out of the emotional experience and you'll just be like, what's that? What was that thing? What was that cut? What was that music cue? And I think that because I know about those things, I'm able to like... intentionally warp them for the purposes of comedy in Evil Everywhere. Is like I'll put musical cues that stand out or like some kind of jarring cut because I want people to sort of be like, what the fuck was that, you know? But all the elements play an important role. I think that there are some filmmakers that, you know, they might write a really good script, but then translating that to film and editing, it's lost in translation and ends up being a jumbled mess. That loses the initial intention. And I think that that's something to be careful about when you're making a film. And as a viewer, I guess, look out for that when you're watching a film.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So did you have a formal film education, or how did you pick up on all the different skill sets and the different knowledge you would need to put together a project like this, or even just use this as a starting point and continue producing into the future?
I think it's because I probably have Asperger's and I'm very hyper focused on the things I'm passionate about. So like, I was the kind of kid who like didn't have friends, but like the only way I was able to relate to the world around me was like obsessively watching movies, TV. I'm obsessed with music. I know a lot about 80s new wave music and gothic rock and punk culture and things like that. And it's very much a part of my personality. Is just to get hyper focused in these different areas of the arts and entertainment industry. And because I started so early, like 8 years old, just fiddling around with a camera, I didn't really know what was what, but I would watch things like Cinema Secrets on TV or whatever, Movie Magic, that series on TV, I think it was on HBO. And then 30 by 30 Kid Flicks hosted by Godfrey was a little thing that was on HBO Kids. And it would be films made by kids and he'd just show them. And like, here's another film made by a 10-year-old. And I would watch those films and go, I could do that. And because my dad was an actor, I understood that the people in the movies that I was watching were also actors, and my brother and I would play in the backyard. So I was able to just piece it all together and go, I take this camera and I have people play things out and I film them. And I would have to edit in camera. So like film it and then cut. There's no editing software back then. And I think it kind of made sense. So by the time I actually did go to film school, I was like 22 years old and I'd already known how to do all this stuff. I'd already made a bunch of short films, but I thought, let me get the formal film school education so I can make the connections and maybe get my hands on some resources and tools that I didn't have access to before living in that isolated suburb. That happened. I got the degree, the associate's degree, film school at Flashpoint in Chicago. And made a few other short films and then eventually decided to make Evil Everywhere and finished that, wrapped that, sent it off. It was picked up for distribution and then made a couple of other short films in between. And here we are.
Interesting. So it seems like from an early age, you just had the right combination of like interest, the family environment, people there to like support these creative interests. Like, yeah. I feel like in my family, if I was going around like, hey, I want to make a movie, my parents would be like, I got to work. Like, I didn't have siblings or anything. So
yeah, it was sort of like, I just kind of remember being in my own world a lot as a little kid. I kind of remember I had my own way of playing with things. The teachers would get worried and they'd say, Michael's off at recess sitting in the corner drawing in his notepad. Mm-hmm. And like the only reason I did that is because I didn't know how to relate to the other kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that being kind of like a weird, eccentric, you know, slightly Asperger's type of kid just kind of meant that like I had my own way of figuring things out and figuring myself out and knowing who I was at an early age in defiance of who everybody else around me wanted me to be. Luckily nobody really challenged that too much. I mean, I had bullies and mean people in my life, but nobody ever was trying to make me anything but a filmmaker. I was never pressured into doing anything else. So it was just a matter of, I just have been looking to just make the right kinds of connections so I can actively pursue this more frequently, you know, put myself in an environment that really fosters that creativity. And I just love working with other people and trying new things.
So do you feel like going and getting like the formal film education from Flashpoint, did that add as much as you thought it would? Or was it kind of like, I kind of already know a lot of this stuff, you know, I'm just kind of getting the piece of paper?
Not to slam on the school or education in general, but it was kind of like, I already knew this stuff. Mm-hmm. And there were elements of it that just kind of felt stressful. I remember having panic attacks every single day and rushing to my academic advisor worried that I was going to fail, and I aced every semester. So it like really triggered my anxiety. I remember I was up to 3 packs a day smoking. Oh, wow. And I think that while I was in film school, I had this weird complex inside of me that was like, I can't be me. I can't be, they're not letting me be me. So I have to be somebody else because they want me to make commercial films and I can't be me. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated film school, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to make some weird films. I'm going to make really weird films that nobody gets because that's how I'm going to stand out. And that's how I'm going to be an authentic creative soul. I'm going to make the weirdest stuff that nobody understands because I love David Lynch and John Waters and people like that. And they don't give a crap what anybody thinks. They do what they want. And I like that. I like being that sort of creative person. And I think I am. And it's just really about finding other people who like align with that vision and also dig what I'm doing and they want to get involved. So it's a risk. It's a risk when you know you're not commercial and you just really want to do what you do. And I think that requires a certain level of integrity to give myself some credit because I know I can be very hard on myself and insecure sometimes. Mm-hmm. But like the fact that I just want to kind of do the things I want to do and I don't want to pander and bow to any sort of like trends or anything like that. I'd say like kudos to any artist out there that's doing something like that, because that's what's going to make you stand out from the crowd. Everybody's doing these COVID movies about people wearing masks and doing Zoom meetings and stuff, and it's like, that's going to be out of fashion in a year. That's going to, you know, that loses its relevancy. I just think do things that you really care about, whether or not other people understand. If you really care about it and it's this like biting passion within you that needs to be expressed, by all means express it.
Interesting.
And then deal with the consequences later, I guess.
Right. So it seems like unless you're really looking to go and make like, you know, Avengers large scale type movies, film school may not be the place for you if you're looking to like make films as a creative person and kind of express the vision you want to express. It doesn't seem like the college education equipped you for that, or at least they didn't gear the curriculum for that kind of person.
No, and I think to their credit, they're doing a good job of what they are doing, which is getting you ready for the industry. But I kind of knew even back then, I'm like, I don't want to start off as a PA and work myself my way to the top with the hopes that I'll make it. I'm going to make the things I want to make and do my best to make it as my own entity in the creative world, because I really envy, or not envy, I'd say I really am influenced by those, you know, renegade creators out there, the punk rockers and the people like John Waters with film, right. who stand out, and they know they stand out and they just keep doing it. They persist and they're loud and they're proud and they're out there, and eventually people take notice and they like them because they're different. And I think that that's something that has been important for me as a person, is to really hone in on who I am independently of society. Don't try to fit in. Just try to be the best version of me and ask myself, do I really want to do this? Does this really say what I want it to say? And be true to myself. And then the right audience will, over time, gravitate to the things you're doing.
Right.
And I think that's sort of more of my motto. And I think the film school motto is like, this is how it works in the industry. Mm-hmm. So a punk rock type of guy like me, sort of, you know, I'll sit there in the class going, yeah, that's what you say. I'm going to do it my way. Yeah, what do you know? But it was a good experience. You know, it's always a good experience like that. And I was around a lot of other creative people and I made some connections. And a lot of those, you know, guys and gals ended up helping me with Evil Everywhere. So it was cool.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's the real, you know, value in college, is the connections you make, the relationships, and just learning the world's bigger than where you come from.
Yeah.
But do you think that kind of that struggle you had between like, this is what, you know, is expected in the industry and like what you wanted to do personally, do you think that is also kind of reflective of how the film industry has changed, especially since like the 70s, 80s time, when there were kind of these smaller, as you put it, more like renegade directors who could find mainstream success kind of doing their own projects? Whereas now, if you want to get any kind of backing, it seems like you kind of have to bend to the whims of the producers that are giving you that money to a pretty large degree. Like, how different do you think your journey would have been if you were born in like the 60s or 70s instead of, you know, closer to...
I think it would have been harder for me to actually make films because of the nature of buying film and cutting film, and there wouldn't have been many opportunities for me to screen them. So I'm very blessed to have been born when I was, in the early 90s. And I think there's always going to be a certain level of compromise. And I do want to get into the world of actually having proper funding. And I don't think I'm always going to be such an auteur. I think that there's going to be times where I'm like, you know what? I'm there now. I kind of want more help. I don't want to always be one man with a camera doing everything by himself. I think there's a lot of limits to that, if I'm being honest. The only reason I ever worked that way is because I wanted to get these visions created. Mm-hmm. And my end goal was just to have the film made, because I cared about the vision. And I think there's a little bit of a dance between my own integrity and then success and commercial success, where I feel like I'm dancing, where I don't mind doing things that will be less of my vision and more of a commission thing, or something that I will have to meet a certain criteria, because of course I want to be successful. Of course I'm aiming for success in the film industry. And I think that there are ways to do commercial things that are very accessible and great. I love a lot of films that have been coming out in the past 10 years that are more commercial, but maybe a bit indie. And I notice at the beginning of those films, you usually see 5 different production companies. So they've got a lot of different hands in the pot, I guess. I don't know what the saying is, but I would love that. I would love that, of course. If I knew better ways to fund my films, I'm totally open. I kind of feel like I'm just starting to scratch the surface, because the film that's coming out first professionally was something I did absolutely with no real help and no budget. And I haven't even dipped into that whole fundraising stuff yet. And so that's maybe the next step for me, is just finding people that would be interested in investing and helping me out on the financial side of things. And I don't have too much pride to bend to somebody's suggestions. Come on, man. I love what I do, but I'm some dude who came from Lake Bluff, Illinois, and I'm aiming for the stars. So of course I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make some compromises here and there along the way. You gotta sometimes.
Of course.
Yeah, but I can still kind of keep my voice. And I think that's the cool thing, is understanding my own voice and then understanding how to make that work for the nature of whatever project I'm working on.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So what were some of your best memories, or like what was the best part of making Evil Everywhere?
I had a lot of fun. We shot most of the scenes with the three lead characters. I play one of the lead characters, and then I act alongside this actor and this actress that play the guy and girl leads. And we had to film their scenes back to back on a Saturday and Sunday. So every time you see the three of us on camera, that was filmed 2 days in a row, and we would literally film one little dialogue exchange and then get into the car and drive over to the next location and do the next bit of dialogue. And I'm like, okay, guys, this next scene we're gonna do a costume change. This happens later in the film. And we do a costume change and we do that one scene. And then it's like, okay, tomorrow we're all gonna meet up again and we have to do the interior scene for the Haunted Mansion. So it was crazy. And like, I was working with a friend of mine who was DPing those scenes. He was filming them. And he was saying, dude, don't you want to like take a little bit more time? I'm like, we don't have time, because these people need to be back by 8 o'clock. And there's going to be, you know, sundown. So we got to rush through these scenes. I think just the fact that like I had to work with the fact that people did not have time to dedicate to this, but I needed to get the shots. It made it sort of like a silly Ed Wood type of challenge, where I'm literally like, all right, that's good enough. We got to move on. And like in the back of my mind, I'm like, I probably should have reshot that, but we just don't have time. So it was ridiculous. I think that kind of adds to the humor of it, because like, it's kind of embarrassing to watch a little bit, because I'm watching my own performance like, oh God, dude, come on. Like, do that line read again, Mikey. But it's like, we had to rush through that stuff. I wish I could have more time individually, scene by scene. There's a scene later on in the film where this girl invites her boyfriend over, and the boyfriend's kind of a creep. And she's been possessed by the evil, and she proceeds to stab him in the stomach about 500 times and then gut him and stare at him while he dies. And then she saunters off into the night a zombie. And it's just like, it's so excessive. And that was so fun to film, because that's where I built that set in the garage. And I had this girl sit on top of this guy, and his body was going through the bed, and there was like a fake body on top of the bed, so she could stab into it and reach into it and pull out the fake guts. And we were just in this hot garage in the middle of July and sweating, covered in fake blood. And I'm like, do you guys want to take a break? It's like, it's cool by me if you want to take a break. You're doing so good. And they're like, no, we're in this. It's hot. It's sick. And we're doing this.
We gotta get through it.
There were such troopers. I'm like, I cannot thank you guys enough. Thank you so much. Everybody in this film, thank you so much. I know nobody was being paid. I lost tons of money. But what fun. I love it. If I didn't love it, I wouldn't keep doing it, you know?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what do you want your audience to take away from watching this movie? Like, what kind of thought or emotion or experience do you think, like, if the audience has it, fucking mission accomplished? That was the whole point.
I hope you just enjoy it and have a good time and laugh and are eager to check out the rest of the stuff that I do, because I honestly think I've gotten much better as a filmmaker since I made this. And I'm really excited about this next film, The Bride, because I'm going to kind of address some of the issues that I had with Evil Everywhere. Of course, as I said, I wrapped that. I edited that. I finished editing in 2019, so I had filmed most of it by 2018. And I think I've gotten way better as a filmmaker now, and I'm seeing kind of the mistakes I made in Evil Everywhere, and I'm hoping to sort of use that as a learning experience. But most of all, I hope that people enjoy this and laugh. I guess, you know, this is not a film that I meant to change the world. If anything, I'm glad it's being released at the time it is, because I think if it was released last year, it would have been very poor taste. What with the pandemic situation, we're kind of like getting out of the pandemic. It's kind of putting a damper on the pandemic right now. We're getting over it, healing, everything like that. Now is a pretty good time to release it. You know, I don't like to make apocalyptic films and release it at a grueling time in our country, you know?
At an apocalyptic time?
That was never the intention. That was never the intention, but I think that hopefully we can have a good laugh and understand that this wasn't made as a response to COVID. It's just being released kind of while we're phasing out of that section of history.
Right. So in the movie, you, from what I understand, the evil that you're talking about, is it a demon? Because that was my understanding, that it was like kind of a demon possession sort of situation. Yeah. Or is it more like a curse sort of thing?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's both. It's sort of like the classic built on an ancient burial ground storyline.
Ah, okay.
But not really. It's the mansion. Well, I think it was. I think it is kind of a curse, an Indian curse, if I remember correctly. There's a big expository scene where the professor tells me all about the ancient evil, and he details why things happened in the first movie and why they're happening again now. And it was this brilliant piece of expository line reading that the actor Brian Harmony gave in that scene. He added the little tidbit of dialogue at the end. He's like, "Stay away from there. That mansion has evil everywhere." And I was like, "Oh, you name dropped the film. Good job." That was ad-libbed by him. I thought it was awesome. But yeah, it's like an ancient evil curse that cursed the town. And there's the guy that built the haunted mansion, and he has something to do with the curse, which is kind of like a reference to Ghostbusters, with that Dana's building being the hub for the evil. In this film, it's this haunted mansion is the hub for the evil, so it's sort of the epicenter. And at the end of the film, we figure out we need to go in there, we need to take down the evil at its source. So that's kind of the deal of this. But the evil manifests in different ways, so it'll show up kind of like, to make it look like the characters killed themselves, or sometimes it forms as this like ghoulish demon character and it will just, you know, kill the characters, or sometimes it will possess somebody like it did with the girl who stabs her boyfriend. So there's a lot of different ways that the evil manifests, and yes, it is a metaphor for negativity and things like that that happen within us. So
sure. Interesting. So it's an entity that has some sort of agency, if it can like keep doing all these things, and it can show up in different forms, different motives. Without, you know, giving anything away, when I watched what was that movie, Sinister, it was a pretty well done movie, I thought, but the thing I liked most about it is that they picked a demon or like a dark god that nobody heard about, because it's like such a stock thing to go, oh, it was the devil, or oh, it was like generic demon A or whatever from hell. They picked a very obscure Babylonian god where there's really not a whole lot of information, so it's a very flexible concept. You can kind of do whatever you want with it. Was there any sort of like research you did into any like specific mythology, folklore that you saw and went like, that's the kind of thing I'm going for? Or was this just entirely kind of your own conception?
In the first short film, Power of Tuto, it was found out that the evil force was fear itself. So in this film, similarly, it's just the force of fear. The energy of fear and evil has manifested as this like embodiment, this curse that's sort of omnipresent, and it forms and functions in different ways. Like, you know, it could possess you, or, you know, turns into a ghoul. And so there's a lot of that. And it was, at the time I made Power of Tuto, I was dealing with a lot of, you know, depression and anxiety issues and bipolar. And so it was very much a metaphor for me to make that film and address those kinds of things that I was dealing with, but in like a hokey kind of cheesy horror way, where the fear is something that we have to face and take down. So yeah, it's sort of the same concept. I tried not to get too much into the details of what it was, because I like kind of keeping it vague and mysterious and leaving it open to interpretation by the audience.
Interesting. Okay. That's cool. As I mentioned before, you got a lot of other projects kind of going on. You do music, you do art. You mentioned the solo project for the music you do. Tell me a little bit more about the art aspect of it. Is it like painting or collages? I saw both online.
Yeah.
Is there more to it? Or?
I do painting and I do collage, like you said. And that's mostly what I do in terms of physical art right now. I draw these weird characters. I paint these strange anthropomorphic vegetables and things like that. I like that kind of like crazy Rat Fink style art, that like hot rod motorcycle type art, where it's like the overly detailed kind of creepy characters like that, with the big eyes and the, you know, grumpy faces and stuff like that. So I do that, and I do these collages that are sort of like Somebody once said to me that they look like they're uneven but somehow balanced at the same time, and I said, well, that's an analogy for me as a human being. They're very stream of conscious. I don't think about, oh, this is going to be a collage about this. I just sort of like let it happen. And that's what I've been doing since childhood. I've always been artistic. So it's not one thing, I'm doing the other thing. You know, if it's not music, I'm doing art, I'm doing film, I'm doing all three at the same time, is my ideal life goal.
Interesting. Now, there's a clear connection between like the music and the film, because you wrote the score for the movie. Mm-hmm. And you were saying like the music from It Follows kind of lent a great deal of influence over how you did the score that you wanted to fit in and create the right mood for the movie. Does the art have a similar connection to whenever you're thinking or working on a film or working on a piece of music? Does the art get affected?
I tend to feel like one medium kind of speaks better to certain things I'm feeling than the other one. So there are some times where I'm like just in art mode and I need to just do art. Because whenever I'm trying to challenge like emotionally or energetically, it's like, I'm going to do art. Like that's all I feel like doing. But when it comes to a film, to me, all of the elements matter. So it's like from the music to the look of it. I usually, I'll kind of listen to a lot of music that evokes the feeling that I want to put into the movie. So while I was making Evil Everywhere, I was listening to a lot of music from around the time period that it's set, 1987. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to a lot of music, like scores from films that evoked the kind of feeling that I wanted. And so I did a few of the music cues in the film. And because I was so already overworked and overwhelmed putting the film together, I outsourced some of the music to friends of mine who were also composers, and they were able to do a few score pieces here and there. And so the score is a jumble of me, friends of mine, royalty-free music, and I wanted to create this atmosphere that sounded authentic and sounded like an actual 80s B-movie soundtrack.
Did you find that like any of the pieces that you painted or any of the collages that you made during that time kind of correlated with the film project, or were they still sort of their own thing?
They were sort of their own thing, but as I recall, around that period, I was dealing with a lot of internal issues, like a lot of stuff. I was having bipolar issues and really just kind of struggling, but the film was like my rock. The film was like the thing that was keeping me on my feet, basically. It's like, I care so much about this. I'd have a panic attack, I'd completely fall apart, get back on my feet and go right at it again. And I think that's a testament to the power of the arts and entertainment. If you're just that passionate about it, that it so encompasses your life in a positive way. And a lot of the art that I made around that time was very evocative of the internal struggles I was having. There's a lot, I can't look at some of it, honestly. I'll have it on my walls, but I'll hide it behind something, or I'll keep it in the closet because it's kind of a negative, you know, image. You know, it's a negative feeling I get from it. It takes me back to a bad place. And I think that that's kind of one of the cool things. It's a double-edged sword about creating art. When you create art from a really hard, difficult place, you get it out of your system in a very tangible and constructive way. But then when you look at it later, it can bring you back sometimes to those memories and those feelings. And so I think that's why, as a creator, I will pass these things off into the world to be enjoyed and interpreted in different ways. So it's not, you know, once it's done, it's out there and it's for others to interpret and enjoy as they please. But I don't have to sit with that same mentality and that same memory necessarily. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. So here's a question about kind of like a general process question, that if anybody listening to this recording is doing something like creative, having to do with music or art or even film, this is probably something they've experienced. When you have like a creative block, when you're in the process of painting or coming up with a script or a piece of music or something, first of all, what's the most common block you experience? And then, like, how do you work through that?
The most common block is knowing the limitations of the resources and things I have available to me to execute my vision. And sometimes I'll have this grandiose vision, and the frustrating part about that will be, I would need this thing to make it happen. I will need this thing. So sometimes that thought process can get in the way of that creative flow, and I'll be like, well, how am I going to do that? And I think that's the most debilitating thing. I kind of feel like if I were given the resources that I need, the actors, the people, the the help that I need, the financial support I need, I would have an easier time flowing that creative energy and those creative ideas, because they naturally just show up all day. I kind of have these little fragmented ideas that show up. And I started listening to David Lynch, where he's like, when you get a fragmented idea, like, write that down if you can, like, extrapolate on it if you can, if it's just a little image in your head, think about that image more and see what that's about. So I compare myself to David Lynch in the way that he thinks, because he seems to think the same way, where he'll get these bits and pieces of something and he'll kind of stew on it a little bit until it forms into something more tangible. And I like that process. And I think that sometimes to kill the creative process is just to introduce a little too much reality into it, where it's like, well, I can't do that. I don't have that access to this thing. Mm-hmm. But I think what's important is just let yourself think the thoughts and let the ideas come. And if they're good ideas, write them down, because you never know, in the future you could have everything you need to make that happen. And I think that sometimes it seems like some creative minds will introduce this idea of, well, who would watch that? So I think that's a surefire way to kill creativity, is worrying about who's going to like that. I tend to train myself out of that kind of thinking and stop thinking about who's going to like this or who is this for, and just go with, you know, if I do this, am I able to do it? Am I able to, you know, produce this idea? So I think that a way to get back into the creative flow is to stop pressuring yourself to be in the creative flow. Go do other things, take care of other things. And I'm working on a painting here that's taken me 2 weeks to paint. Because I'll paint a little bit of it, and then I'll be honest with myself and say, I'm not feeling this right now, and I'll put it away. Don't force yourself to create things. Unless you're on a deadline, you don't need to force yourself to create things. You want to flow into the creativity. You want to feel that inspiration start up. Even if it's like a little teeny thing, like, I'm going to take out my easel and I'm going to do some painting. Follow that inspiration, but don't try to force yourself to do it all at once, because I think that that's a detriment to the creative process.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, mm-hmm. Very cool. So now I got just a little game here.
Awesome.
And the game we got planned this week, we're going to play the Hear Me Out game, which I'm sure everybody remembers from when Chevy was on, played this game. It's very simple. We just take turns drawing cards from the deck. On the card, there is a prompt, and you take turns about a minute and a half to 3 minutes to talk about the prompt, and we just switch every turn. Very simple. No points involved, just kind of a fun little game.
All right.
So, you want to go first or me?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I'll go, I guess.
All right. You got a good one here. Convince others that you've been reincarnated. Go ahead.
I like things that a guy my age doesn't usually like. I'm very fascinated with the 1800s. I'm fascinated by the Victorian era. I have very old-fashioned belief systems in certain areas of life. There are times where as a kid, I felt very drawn to older people and didn't connect to my own age kids. And I seem to know about things that a kid wouldn't know about. And that people would go, how do you know that? Or they'd say, you're very wise for your age. And I always kind of felt like I was reincarnated. Not to mention, at age 2, I told my parents that my name was Jim and I used to play piano for a lot of people, and they all clapped. So they felt like I was reincarnated, and it was theorized that they thought that I was Jim Morrison, but I don't think so. likely, I was probably an artist and a filmmaker and actor in other lives, too.
Interesting. Okay. Good solid start. All right. Mine is, what are the qualities of a true gentleman? Fuck, I don't know. Gee, that's a tough one. Don't be a dick. I feel like that's a big one.
Yes,
don't be a dick. Regardless of like how you dress or like how much money you have, if you're an asshole, then like that's like
you're out of here, Buster.
Yeah. besides that, I mean, there's this idea like, oh, chivalry's dead. I'm like, well, chivalry's from the 1800s. So I think what you mean to say is that society's different now, right? Like.
Yeah.
The mannerisms of what we accept as like respectful, and like how we interact with each other, especially across like gender lines and stuff.
Yeah.
It's just different now. It's not like, oh, that's not a chivalrous gentleman. It's just like, well, yeah, because we treat women like people now, so that's gonna look a little different than it did in the 1800s. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Qualities of a gentleman. I feel like that's just the biggest one. Don't be a dick. Be respectful to people.
Mm-hmm.
Try to leave more than you take at the end of the day. That's all I got for that. What's about
sure.
it? All right. So, all right. Here you go. things were better when you were a kid. Explain.
I don't think they were better when I was a kid. I think things are better now. I think that I was just a kid at the time, so I thought they were better because I didn't have any responsibilities, and I basically just ran around in the yard with other kids playing all day and filming little movies. And I kind of want to recapture that as an adult. That's kind of my ideal creative situation, is just being around creative people 24/7 and constantly being in that sort of like, hey, are you around? Are you around? Let's do something. Let's create something. I'm very hypomanic. I'm very, like, that's where I thrive, is that sort of like high energy, ooh, I'm going to do this. And being a kid lets you do that because you're not expected to do anything else besides go to school. But I will say I dug watching like Goosebumps, and Nickelodeon was really good back in the late 90s when I was a kid. Oh, yeah. Kenan and Kel, all that, Rugrats, all that stuff. I love that stuff. Pete and Pete. but you can watch that stuff now, so it's not so different. I think the difference now is that kids back then weren't glued to a phone, and they didn't do video game systems as much. You just kind of went out in the yard and played, and were in person together in the same room together. And that's kind of what I would like to see more of these days, is just go out and play and be with each other. Don't be on a phone.
Yeah, no, I feel that. I feel that. Okay, so this next one, it requires both of us, and you're going to need to give me some pushback on this, or this is going to end very quickly.
Okay.
Okay, so persuade another player to join your undertaking film. So I know you probably could be like, yeah, sure, let's do it. But okay. Give me some pushback here. Give me some resistance.
You want me to convince you or dissuade
you? No, I'm convincing you.
Okay.
To be in my film.
Okay, convince me.
All right, here we go. All right, so Mikey, check it out. I got this movie idea. There's very little budget. I found $20 under my desk. That's the bulk of the budget, I'm not going to lie. But check it out. It's a period piece, right? It's going to be the I don't know, 1800s, right?
Okay.
In England, and it's going to be like a slasher film. So it's kind of like it's kind of like an homage to Jack the Ripper, and I want you to play Jack the Ripper.
Where is it being filmed?
Well, we're mostly working with the park down the street, my neighborhood, and anywhere that's free. That seems to be the main thing.
I don't live where you live. How am I going to get there? I don't even drive a car. How am I going to get there?
How do you not drive a car? What? Okay.
Because I never learned and never got a license.
I know someone who's like in your area who's also going to be on the project, so they'll just pick you up. They'll just swing by, grab you, and come to the filming.
Nah, man, I'm working on my own film, and that's a lot of work already. I got to get actors for my film, so are you going to help me get actors for my film?
I mean, if you think about it this way, if you come and work on my film, you can meet all the other actors. You can kind of, you know, network a little bit, see who you like, because you get to watch them in action while we're filming. So you can kind of see who you like, and then if you see someone who you think is really good, you can have them go over and work on your film as well.
I don't want to put out an image that I'm a bad guy. I don't like playing bad guy characters, you know. I want to give out the image that I'm a good person. But it's my name in the credits, though. You know, I don't want my name associated with being evil or killing people, you know. Okay. despite the fact that I made evil everywhere, I don't want my name. I don't want to be playing any more evil villainous roles in my life, you know.
All right, that's about a minute, so we'll go to the next one. This one's you. Oh boy, defend Jerry Springer. I guess the show or the person, it's up to you.
Don't we all need to see the degeneracy of society on TV so we can watch it and go, oh, at least I'm not like that. At least my life is a little more calm than that. I don't have to worry about those things. It shows you sides of society that you don't usually see. And yes, it's trashy, but trashy entertainment is fun. Sometimes things are too sterilized on TV and in movies, and it's always good to see a little bit of like rough and tumble underbelly of society type of underdog material. And I love that. The loud energy is really fun, and you can watch that show and get so many ideas and for art and characters and all kinds of things. And it wouldn't be the 90s without Jerry Springer. I mean, everybody knows his name, and he's the guy that you go to if you have terrible relationships and you live in a gutter.
There you go. That was a solid like minute and a half. Okay. Oh boy. Perform sound effects for 45 seconds. Not 45.
Okay.
Minutes, 45 seconds. So that one's on me. Okay. Here's a car. And then you hit a dog. So that was like, and you're like, shit. It was that bit. What else? Car's the main one I know. I don't know a whole lot of other sound effects. I don't know. Maybe I could do like a baby.
How about a siren?
A siren. Oh, okay.
Police are coming because of the car accident.
I got that one. All right. Woo! 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 That sounds more like a paramedic band.
We're in the UK. We're in the UK siren.
That's what it is. That's what it is. All right, that's about 45 seconds. Half that was me thinking, but that's okay. All right, we got probably like this one. After this one, one more each, and then we're probably done.
Okay, cool.
Why do the clothes make the man? Go.
I wear women's clothes. I'm a bad judge of that. But the clothes make the man because you want to dress for the job that you want and not the job you have. I like to dress like a weird punk rock rock star because I am a weird punk rock star. I dress like a gothic artist, like I would be in coming out of the 80s rock scene. I think you want to dress to the effect of what you're going for. Even when you're just sitting around your house, you want to be in that energy. You want to live that role. You don't want to sit around in slacks sweatpants because you like to dress to be the best. You dress for the best every day, even when nobody's looking at you. Dress the way you feel confident and comfortable, as if the paparazzi is going to bust through your door and take photos of you. I think that that's very important. You want to carry that affect of being at your best as often as you can. And a good way to do that is just wear clothes that you like and feel are cool, I guess.
And I'm wearing sweatpants right now, so...
Shame on you!
Right, I'm not living up to that standard, shit. Alright, one more piece. So here's mine. This one you'll also kind of be involved with. I'm on a fancy date at a restaurant when a cockroach crawls across the table. Complain to the waiter. Alright. So, I guess you're the waiter in this situation. Okay. Alright. Excuse me, waiter, real quick.
Yeah, come here.
I just saw a cockroach crawl across my table when I was trying to eat. Yeah, so, like, is the food free? Like, how does that work?
Well, cockroaches, we're not liable for any insects or rodents found on the premises.
Actually,
there's a statement out by the front door that says any rodents or cockroaches found are not our responsibility. Actually, the customer is responsible.
How are you guys still open? What the fuck?
Because Gordon Ramsay gave us a 5-star review in Zagat. And we're just.
Did he know about the cockroaches? Did he know about this?
This is that the cockroaches are intentional. It adds to the atmosphere of the restaurant. We are trying to give off a New York bodega vibe, and we think that the cockroaches really help sell that affect. And
there's a dress code. I had to be like in a suit to get in here, and there's cockroaches over here.
We're going for Upper Manhattan bodega with a fancy attire, as if we are next to a gentleman's club.
You guys are charging $5 for a water. Like, come the fuck on here.
That's why we got the good review on Zagat.
Because it's expensive and it's full of roaches?
Expensive clientele and solid atmosphere.
I had to put in a reservation a week ago just to get a table here. And the lady on the phone, I think her name was Jasmine, she said there would be no roaches here. And I asked.
She's been fired. She was mistaken. Wow. My apologies, sir. The roaches come free with every experience here at our fine establishment.
How much do I have to pay to not get the roaches? That's my question.
You would have to reserve a date on one of our no roach dates. Could I show you a calendar?
Well, I guess since we're already fucking here, you may as well.
Great, I'll get that when I come back with your bill. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. All right. All right, last one. This one's for you. Why are vinyl records better than CDs?
Because it's so cool, man. I used to have a ton of vinyl, and I liked the experience of, like, cleaning them, putting them on the actual turntable, putting the needle on. That click and that crackle of the vinyl sounds really nice. And through a nice hi-fi system, it seems to me like you can hear the resonance of each instrument a little bit better than when you're listening to a CD. The CD kind of crushes it, but I think on vinyl, it seriously sounds like it has more fidelity. Like, there's, like... You can hear the air between the instruments. And oh man, isn't it so great to go into like a used record store and you find like stuff that you like, but there it is on vinyl and it's like $5 and you're like, how can I pass this up? And you take it home and you put wood glue on it and you peel the wood glue off and it's like the record is like new and you put the alcohol or whatever. Don't put alcohol on it.
Oh God.
It dries and it's sticky. No, that's bad advice. But anyway, when it's clean, it sounds fantastic, man. You haven't heard music until you've heard vinyl, man. Was that 45 seconds?
That was pretty close. Yeah, you were like minute and 20 or so. That was pretty solid. Right.
I overshot it. Yeah.
That was good. All right, right on. Well, that's pretty much all we got time for today. So go ahead and just take a few seconds to go ahead and plug everything. Let people know where they can see the movie. It's coming out the 25th of the month. Where can they watch it? Where can they find your stuff?
Well, look up Wild Eye Releasing. It's on your website. Look up Evil Everywhere on Amazon. It's available for pre-order, or if this airs after the 25th, it'll be on Amazon. I believe on DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming, if I'm not mistaken. And then check out MikeyMortini.com. I just set up a link tree today. I think it's like linktree/ Mikey M, and it has all my links. Or you could go to Facebook.com/MichaelMortini. And that's my personal page. Don't friend me and send things. whoops! I'd say go to my website and I've got links to other things. I got a lot of links, guys. YouTube.com/MordaciousFilms.
There you go. He's got links. Fantastic. We'll be including those links in the show notes of this week's episodes. If you want to scroll down, check those out. You can find everything he just was talking about. And get ready for the May 25th release of Evil Everywhere. Mikey, thanks for coming on. Had a great time with you. It was very interesting.
Me as well. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. You go get your COVID shot and please contribute to the solution and not be part of the problem.
Yep.
All right. Fantastic.